Welcome to another edition of Garden Talk. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Great to have you with us today as we take a look at prairies and prairie plants with our guest, Neil DeBoll. Neil's president of Prairie Nursery. He co-authored The Gardener's Guide to Prairie Plants and is recognized internationally as an expert in native plant community ecology. So we'll talk with him about how to care for prairie gardens in the fall and, of course, answer all your questions. What would you like to know about adding natives to your landscape? Are you looking for a recommendation for native plants for a specific area? Join in the conversation. Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. Or send an email to ideas@WPR.org, ideas@WPR.org. Neil DeBoll, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Thanks, Larry. It's great to be back with you.
Tell you what, I was looking at your book again this morning, The Gardener's Guide to Prairie Plants. I hope it's doing well. Is it?
That's what they tell me. I don't know. They don't tell us much. You know, we're just mushrooms. So, but supposedly it's doing well. But I mean, what is well? They printed 7,500 copies, which I thought was low. They said it was high. So what do I know about anything? So, but anyway, I know they're working on another printing. So it seems to be doing okay.
That's great. It's a lovely book, a wonderful book. And I think anybody interested in prairies and prairie plants should have a copy or at least access to one and maybe at the library. But let's talk for a minute about no-mow lawns. We had a turf expert with us, and we talked about no-mow lawns. You're not a lawn expert, but tell us about the no-mow lawn option that Prairie Nursery offers.
Well, our no-mow lawn product, we've had it on the market for 29 years. Started in 1994. And originally, I wanted to use native grasses for lawns. And so back in the 80s, early 90s, buffalo grass and blue gramma grass were all the rage because they stay naturally low. And so people were recommending them for planting in the Midwest and even into the East. The only problem is the buffalo grass and blue gramma grow in the Great Plains where they get about 10 to 15 inches of rain a year. The wind is constantly blowing and it's hot and dry. And when you plant them in climates where they get 30, 40 inches of rain a year, and it's not really dry, they are easily taken over by cool season weeds like quackgrass, brome grass, et cetera. So my experiments were not working because, hey, what do you think? These plants aren't native here, so they're not going to probably do very well. Not that just because a plant isn't native somewhere doesn't mean it won't do well, but these plants grow in a completely different meteorological zone of low rainfall, dry conditions, desiccating winds. So I tried for a few years to get it to work, and it didn't work. So I said, my goodness, okay, let me talk to the turf experts. So I went to the turf experts at the O.J. Knorr Turfgrass Research Center at UW-Madison, and they said, well, if you want a low-maintenance lawn, look at fine fescues. So we trialed all these different combinations of different formulations of fine fescues and settled on the one that actually we're still using to this day. And fine fescues, although they are not native to our region, they are perfectly adapted to growing here, and they are low nutrient requiring, low moisture requiring grasses, so they're very low maintenance. So they make a great solution, especially for drier soils, like sandy soils and rocky soils. Where they do not do well is on heavy clay soils and on wet soils. They hate moisture. So if you have a wet area, hey, that's what Kentucky bluegrass is for. It loves a moisture soil. And, you know, people will belittle or denigrate Kentucky bluegrass, but there's a reason why that is the go-to turf grass. That stuff is tough. It will grow in clay. It will tolerate close mowing. There's a lot to be said for it, but it does require more nutrients. It requires generally more mowing, although you can maintain a Kentucky bluegrass lawn at 3 to 4 inches, and it's perfectly fine. You just mow it once a month instead of once a week. But anyway, so the no-mow lawn is such that you, and it's a little bit of a misnomer. You do need to mow it at least once a year. Some people mow it 2 times, 3 times a year. But you can keep it mowed at about 3.5 to 4 inches, which also helps to control weeds. Because if you are constantly mowing your lawn closely, that promotes low-growing plants like dandelions, creeping charlie, a lot of these guys that like it when you mow them because it removes the competition from the grass. If you let your grass grow longer, it will smother those weeds out. That's the easy way to get rid of dandelions. Mow your lawn a few times a year, and the dandelions will be gone in a couple of years. So that's the beautiful thing about lawn care is you mow and you fertilize and you grow faster, bigger weeds, and you create the perfect conditions for weeds, and then you have to buy all the chemicals to kill the weeds. It's like being on one of those little rat wheels.
So what does the lawn look like under your mixture?
Well, the normal lawn will, if you don't mow it, will actually start to kind of lay down and flow, okay? So it's really kind of a cool effect. It's really, some people like it. If you like a totally cropped lawn, you'll hate it. So, and if you want to play croquet in it, forget about it. Ain't going to happen, okay? You're in the rough all the time. So, and you will have to lift your feet more to get over it. So you can, you know, if you are not able to walk easily, you will probably trip on it because you have longer grasses that are 4, 5, 6 inches long. But if you want a low maintenance area that looks really nice and you don't have to fertilize it, unless you have extremely poor soil, you shouldn't have to add any fertilizer to it. And irrigation is not necessary except during very hot, dry weather in the summer, because this stuff is really tough and much more drought tolerant than almost any other, most of your turf grasses. But if you push it over the edge, you can kill it. But a lot of people will mow it usually in early June when it sends up seed stalks. If you grow it in the sun, it has enough light and enough energy to send up seed stalks. They get about knee high, approximately 2 feet. When it's grown in the shade, and it is, the fine fescues are the most shade tolerant of all the available turf blends on the market. When you grow it in the shade, it usually doesn't produce seed stock, so it's really a great choice for shady areas where you can't grow a typical sun-loving lawn. So it's a great solution for those situations. Then you can mow it in mid-June at 4 inches. You don't want to mow it too closely because you'll scalp it, and that actually creates habitat for weeds. So you never want to remove more than one-third of the total grass length at any mowing. So usually around early June, you've got about 6-inch long leaves, and you mow it to 4, and then let it regrow over the summer. And the only issue that we really run into with not mowing it on a regular basis is you will get buildup of dead leaves and sometimes thatch. So it really pays to go in late in the season, like around Thanksgiving, assuming that it hasn't snowed by then, and mow it down pretty closely to a couple of inches to remove the extra leaf material, which will smother the new growth the following spring. So that's really important to remove that. And if you can, it doesn't hurt to rake it off, although it's not absolutely necessary. So that's kind of what it looks like. And you can go to our website at prairienursery.com, and there's a number of photos there that you can look at if you so desire.
Yeah, and there's, you know, preparing the soil, it's pretty typical of any grass seed, I would think, isn't it? Or how do you prepare the soil?
That's a really good question, Larry. If you look at the lawn care industry, site preparation is usually not considered really important because they have all these tools to control weeds. Many weeds can be controlled with mowing, not all, as we mentioned earlier. Lower growing weeds actually are favored by mowing, but most weeds can be controlled by mowing at a couple of inches in height, which you can do with bluegrass. And then you got all these chemicals you can spray. You can spray all these different broadleaf weeds with these different, sometimes rather toxic chemicals. So if your goal, and this is where we developed this, was to get away from fertilizers, to get away from herbicides, to get away from all this stuff. So if you really want to have a minimum weed growth, you need to do the work up front and eliminate the weeds prior to seeding. So there's many different ways to eliminate the weeds. If it's a small area, you can smother it for a full year. It depends on what's growing there, but usually we recommend smothering from April until the end of August, and then you can plant your normal lawn in September, because September is the best time to plant cool season grass lawns, whether it's normal fescue, whether it's bluegrass, perennial rye, etc. September is perfect because in September you have usually the perfect temperatures for germination, usually in the 60s and 70s for the highs. You usually have normal rain and not a lot of drought stress, and most of your weeds germinate in spring and summer. In the fall, very few weeds germinate, so the grass will germinate with minimal competition. There are some weeds that do germinate in the fall, but it's really quite minimal. The grass then becomes established in the fall, and then the next spring, it's that nice cool grass growing season, April and May, and it takes control by June with minimal weeds. So you have the option of smothering the area to prepare it. You can till the soil repeatedly to kill the weeds, depending upon what weeds and grasses are. Some people will use glyphosate, i.e. Roundup, to kill the existing vegetation prior to seeding. But after you have killed everything, you should not have to come back and use that again. Now, you will always run into the possibility of weed invasion. It's impossible to keep everything perfectly weed-free. So then you can either dig out the weeds individually, or some people will resort to using very tactical and minimal use of broadleaf weed spray every once in a while. But when you don't mow the lawn all the time, the lawn grasses are able to smother out most, not all, but most weeds. So you stop mowing, you stop doing all that work, and hopefully you'll have less weeds.
And speaking of weeds or kind of weedy-like problems, Louise in Appleton emailed to ask how she can get buckthorn out of her native yard without spraying. Maple seedlings have also inserted themselves, of course.
Yes. Well, we live in a climate where there's sufficient rainfall and the temperatures are moderate enough that trees tend to be what is commonly referred to as the climax community, the end point community. And in the absence of disturbance of either burning, mowing, grazing, then trees and shrubs will take over open grassland areas like a prairie or a lawn if there's no maintenance. So what do you do? If you don't want to use any chemicals, the best thing to do is to find those seedlings when they're young and very carefully pull them or dig them out. Once they start to get a good root system, of course, it becomes much more difficult to manually remove them. So that requires constant vigilance in order to go out and spot those seedlings right away. And once they get established, it depends upon the ecosystem. If it's a prairie, you can burn it to knock back the woody plants and deciduous plants. Of course, if they're established, they will resprout, but they won't grow into full-size trees and shrubs if you burn it every other year. But once those roots get established, it's really hard to get rid of them. Then you might have to use, there's a machine called a weed wrench. There's many different names, but it pulls out woody plants from sod. And it uses a leverage to pull them out, so that's another option if you don't want to use any herbicides. There's also a system called buckthorn baggie where you can cut the plant back to a few inches above the ground. You leave a stub, and you put this baggie over it, and it smothers the plant and prevents it from resprouting. It's a lot of work, but you don't have to use herbicides. So there's a number of different options, but the easiest thing is to find those weeds when they're young, and find those buckthorn seedlings, maple seedlings when they're young, and pull them out. And unfortunately, these things tend to be abundant.
Yeah.
So, abundant. And, you know, that's why people use chemicals. That's why they go out there and spray it, because it's easy and it's cheap and it doesn't take a lot of time and people are busy. So I'm not saying that's what they should do, but that's the reason why these things exist.
Neil DeBole, our guest today, president of Prairie Nursery. Great to have him with us as we talk about prairie plants in the fall, and you can join in now. If you have a question or comment, the number to call is 1-800-642-1234, or you could email us the email address ideas@wpr.org. Give a call, shoot an email. I'm Larry Mueller. Tyler Ditter, our engineer, Jill Nadeau, our producer, for Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. If you have a question about prairies or prairie plantings, you've come to the right place. Larry Mueller here for Garden Talk with our guest, Neil DeBole, president of Prairie Nursery. Again, the number is 800-642-1234. Email to ideas@wpr.org. Aaron emailed to ask if you would please talk about lead plant. He would like to have some in his prairie. When does it seed out, and where can you purchase it? Can you transplant small seeds? Or small plants, excuse me.
Sure. Okay. Well, lead plant is one of the few native shrubs that occurs in our native prairies in Wisconsin and other adjoining states. It's a member of the pea family, or a legume, so it does add nitrogen to the soil by a nitrogen fixation in conjunction with rhizobium bacterium that form nodules on the roots. So it's beneficial to helping other plants in your prairie obtain nitrogen, which also is distributed into the soil to some degree. Lead plant gets about 3 feet tall. It blooms in the heat of midsummer, and it has these beautiful purple flowers, bluish purple flowers with little red highlights on the stamens. So it's really quite attractive, and it has this grayish, bluish, greenish foliage. And some people say that the plant was named lead plant because of the gray foliage. Other people say that it was named lead plant because it grew in southwestern Wisconsin in the prairies and oak savannas of that region, above lead deposits, which, of course, lead was a very big industry in Wisconsin from the 1820s into, well, into the 20th century. So no matter how it obtained its name, it's an extremely long-lived shrub, and it's a really nice addition to the summer landscape, and it looks really good when you plant other lower-growing flowers and grasses around it, like prairie drop seed goes well with it. You can put little blue stem behind it in a garden situation. And there's all sorts of other flowers that you can add to it, particularly early spring-blooming flowers like coreopsis, prairie smoke, et cetera. And it generally does best on well-drained soils. It doesn't like moisture generally. It really is abundant in dry, sandy soils, but it also grows on well-drained loamy and silt loam soils as long as they're well-drained. So it's a very attractive shrub and extremely long-lived. I know plants that have been alive for over 40 years. So can you transplant small plants? Yes, absolutely. We sell this plant in 4-inch pots, which is moderate size. They're not really small, but they're grown out for a full year, and they're easy to transplant. If you grow your own plants from seed, you would want to get them to the point where the root is at least 5 or 6 inches long. It does have a strong taproot. And you want to make sure that you transplant it when it is dormant. If you're growing it in a bare root situation, if you're growing it in a pot, then you can install it at any time because you're not going to disturb the roots when you transplant the soil and the pot, the root and the soil together in a potted plant.
Sounds good to me. It sounds like a wonderful addition. Let's go to Steve in Platteville. Steve, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Well, I was just going to ask your host, when is the best time to dormant seed big blue stem grass?
That's a very good question, Steve. There is no good time to dormant seed big blue stem grass because big blue stem is a warm season grass. And this is really important. This is a great question because if you look at the various plants in the prairie, which includes grasses, some sedges, flowers, and a few shrubs, the warm season grasses do best when planted in May and June, the same time as corn. They're really actually fairly closely related to corn. So big blue stem, little blue stem, Seidel's grama, Indian grass, and switchgrass are best planted in the spring when the soil is warm. When seeded in the fall, most of these grasses exhibit significantly reduced germination the next spring. And when I say seeded in the fall, this is a dormant seeding, meaning that they do not germinate in the fall. They sit in the soil over the winter and then come up the following spring. So warm season grasses generally do very poorly when dormant seeded in the fall. So if your primary goal is the warm season grasses, don't plant them in the fall. You'd want to plant those in May or June, the same time as farmers are planting corn. Now, what is interesting here is that almost all of your prairie flowers do significantly better when planted in the fall as a dormant seeding because they require exposure to cold, damp conditions in the soil to break dormancy, to let them know it's safe to germinate. So let's say I'm a prairie flower seed, and I fall on the ground on September 15th, and it's warm, and it's raining, and everything is beautiful, and I germinate, and 2 months later, it's November 15th, or December 15th, 3 months later, and it's 10 below zero, and I'm dead. I'm out of the gene pool. So there's this built-in mechanism in most of the flower seeds to tell them, hey, I have to go through cold conditions over the winter before I germinate. So that is what is called moist stratification, which is a terminology that was developed from actually pre-treating seed by stratifying it, i.e. putting it in layers of sand and putting it in the refrigerator for a month or whatever, and then taking it out and germinating it in the spring. So if you want to have best results on your flowers, plant in the fall as a dormant seeding. If you want better results on your warm season grasses, plant in the spring in May and June. And you have some cool season grasses and some quasi-cool season grasses like needlegrass and June grass and the Canada wild rye and Virginia wild rye. These generally do best when seeded in the fall. Prairie drop seed, which is kind of weird. It's not warm season. It's not cool season. It's kind of intermediate. It has characteristics of both. That is definitely better seeded either in the fall or very early in the spring, in April or very early May. If you seed prairie drop seed, usually once the temperature gets into the soil gets into the 80s, and that means the air temperature is in the 70s, once the soil warms up, it does very poorly, and it's expensive seed. So you really want to be careful with prairie drop seed planted in the fall or in April to get best results. Now, there's an intermediate option between fall dormant seeding and spring or early summer seeding, and that is frost seeding, which is wherein the seed is applied usually in late February with a small amount of snow on the ground, not a lot. You don't want a lot of snow, but just a little bit of snow, and you actually seed into the snow on frozen ground. And you can then have good results with both the flowers and the grasses by doing a frost seeding. Now, you want to make sure that when you frost seed that the snow cover is not crusted, because the wind will blow the seed right off of that crust, and then you're in big trouble. And you don't want too much snow, because it's really hard to get your equipment in there. And if you get a big rapid snow melt, then your seed can be carried away by a big flush of melting snow water. So that's a good compromise between the fall dormant seeding and the spring or early summer seeding, is that frost seeding, usually late February, early March. And make sure that you go out there when the ground is frozen, or you're going to get your equipment stuck. So you go out in the morning when it's frozen, and then usually in the afternoon or evening or some time later, the soil starts to melt and thaw, and you get this frost action where the soil opens and closes and opens and closes from daytime to nighttime, and then the seed works its way down into the soil prior to germination that spring.
Stephen Platteville, there you go. Thanks so much for calling. Let's go to Steve in Lake Geneva. Hi, Steve.
Yes, hi there. I'm just trying to understand the logic behind mechanical removal of small woody invasives rather than using the cut stump method. Often can be employed with a tag team. I'm just wondering, doesn't mechanical movement disturb the wood seed and the weed seed bank, which can often be quite large, and result in the growth of more woody and, in fact, herbaceous plants? Isn't that one of the virtues of using targeted chemical treatments? And also note the potential for soil erosion when disturbing the soil on slopes with stormwater flows. So I'm just interested in hearing your feedback on that, Neil. Thanks very much.
Sure. Absolutely. That's a very good point. I believe the caller had asked how to do this without using chemicals. And so that's why the response was you can pull the weeds, but if you don't want to use any herbicides. I employ the cut stump treatment on my property, and I'm a big fan of that for the very reasons that you pointed out. It minimizes soil disturbance, and I'm on hills. I have very steep hills, although it's mostly dolomite and sand, so I don't really have big problems with erosion, but that's also a good point. And normally, if you're pulling a lot, if you're pulling only a few, it's not going to be a problem. And if you're pulling them out of an established sod, you have that sod there to, number one, prevent soil erosion, and hopefully have enough residual cover of the existing sod to prevent a lot of germination of weeds. But you're right. Anytime you disturb the soil, you're going to open up to potential erosion as well as weed growth. So for situations where you're okay with using herbicides, the cut stump treatment is great. And you can use specific silvicides like Garlon 3A. Some people will use that. It's very effective. You can use Garlon 4 if you want an oil-based treatment. I like 3A because you don't have to clean up all the oily stuff when you're working with it. And if you want to save some money, most woody plants, deciduous woody plants like buckthorn, honeysuckle, black locust, autumn olive, the list goes on. You don't have to spend the money on the high cost silvicides. You can use concentrated glyphosate for, you know, $20, $25 a gallon instead of $100 a gallon or $75 a gallon. You can use that when you use it in the fall, September, October, November, December, all the way through the winter, and you don't have to use the fancy silvicides that cost much more money. I use it 40% glyphosate, undiluted. Some people will dilute it 50-50 with water. I'm not messing around because I'm only putting a few drops on the cut stump. And I like that method exactly because it does minimal soil disturbance, and it also is very effective. And when you use this, make sure you only treat the cambium. The only living part of most deciduous plants is just inside the bark, about a half inch inside the bark. That is where the vascular tissue, the xylem and phloem is, and that's what transports the herbicide down into the roots and kills it systemically. So you only need to just treat that little ring just inside the bark. I go around it twice, drip, 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 and just very, very topical, minimal use of the herbicide. And one other method here is some people go out there with a paint can and a brush or whatever. It's like, no, don't do that. If you spill that paint can, you got a giant herbicide spill. I get a dishwasher detergent soap bottle that has the kind of top that you pull up, not the one that opens up, but the one you can pull up. And I wash it out when I'm done with it and fill it with the glyphosate. And then you can go out with that and set that top so it just lets out a drip at a time. So it's very, very manageable. And I'm working on these hills. It's really easy to spill stuff. If that thing falls over, it doesn't drip out because I've got it set where you have to actually squeeze a little bit to get a drip of the herbicide out. So it's really a good, safe way to apply the herbicide without creating any sorts of spills.
Neil DeBolle, our guest, you can join in too. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or email to ideas@wpr.org. Get you on pretty quickly. Let's see. Sue in Chippewa Falls emailed. She's in Zone 4. Changed part of her yard to a no-mow lawn. Now she wants to change the rest of the yard, but has a lot of crabgrass, which is going to seed. How and when can she apply a fall pre-emergence for the crabgrass? Is this her best option? And by the way, she says she loves your latest book, Wonderful Plant Tables.
Wow, wonderful. Thanks, Phil. Actually, you do not want to apply a pre-emergent in the fall into turf grass, especially for crabgrass. Crabgrass is a warm season annual. It germinates when the soil warms up, usually in June and July. So applying it now would be a complete waste and unnecessary addition of herbicides to your landscape, because the crabgrass is dying right now and it's producing lots of seeds, but it's not going to germinate now because it doesn't germinate until next spring. So the trick to controlling crabgrass, if you're going to use a pre-emergent, is to apply that in May. Okay. And you might have to do a reapplication in July, depending upon the time that the herbicide, the pre-emergent, is active. So you want to read the label. And there's two things you want to read, is the application time and rate, and is it safe to use on fine fescue turf grass? Because there are many, many different types of pre-emergent herbicides with different formulations to control different weeds, including certain grasses. And there are some pre-emergent herbicides that will harm or kill fine fescue grasses in no-mow lawns. They'll be fine for bluegrass, they'll be fine for perennial rye, but they will not necessarily be fine for fine fescue. So read that label and make absolutely certain that it says that it is labeled for use on fine fescues. So if you're controlling crabgrass and a wide variety of other weeds, like warm season weeds like pigweed and lamb's quarters, et cetera, which tend to be common in the first year of a seeding, you can apply those. But remember that a lot of these weeds will go away after 1 or 2 years as the lawn fills in, and you may find that you don't really have to apply it. It really depends upon how much open soil you have, because that is where these annual weeds will germinate. And make sure that you do not apply any pre-emergence until that lawn is at least 2 to 3 inches tall, because you can harm the young seedlings.
Ross in Middleton emailed. He has a big patch of tick seed flower and would like to transplant some of it to another location. What's the best time to do that?
Okay, when you say tick seed, that is probably the genus Bidens, B-I-D-E-N-S, and there are, among the genus Bidens, there are many species in Wisconsin. They tend to grow in wetlands and moist soils, and they are both annual and perennial. And if you've got annual tick seed, it doesn't pay to transplant it, because you're transplanting a dead plant at this time of year, or a soon-to-be dead plant, okay? So you want to make sure that you identify what species of tick seed you have to make sure that it is indeed a perennial and worthy of your time and effort to transplant it. So once you determine that it is a perennial, most perennials are easily transplanted in the fall after they go dormant, or in the spring before they come up, or just as they're beginning to emerge from the soil. The worst time to plant them is when they're in bloom. So you want to wait until there's a very low stress on the roots to supply the plant with moisture, which is usually after it's dormant in the fall or before it starts to grow in the spring. So there are a few plants that don't do well when planted in the fall, and there's some plants that do better when planted in the fall. An example, not tick seeds, but a lot of your woodland spring ephemerals, like trilliums, and especially trilliums, with trilliums and the plants that come up early, a bloodroot, and Virginia bluebells that are really early, these are always better transplanted in the fall, because then they're pre-positioned for coming up first thing in the spring. And transplanting them in the middle of spring, sometimes they're kind of is really messing with their system, with their cycle, because they're already normally blooming and you're just putting them in the ground and they don't like that all the time. So you want to be careful as far as what the species is. Most of your prairie grasses, they're pretty indestructible. You can transplant them anytime in the fall after they go dormant, or in the spring just as they're coming up. And you can divide them and chop them up, and as long as you don't chop them up too small. Grasses are very unforgiving. And some flowers are really, really sensitive to being transplanted when they're growing, like the shooting star. If you dig up shooting star after it's 2 or 3 inches tall, you're probably going to kill it. It doesn't like to be moved. Unless you're moving the entire clump of dirt around the roots and not disturbing the roots, then you'll be successful. So you want to make sure you know what plant you are transplanting. But general rule of thumb, transplant in the fall after the plants go dormant or in the spring before they come up.
Mary in New London emailed to say she planted 3 choke cherries in spring, needed to protect them from deer and small critters this winter. They're about 2 feet tall. Can you explain the process of digging a trench to place the chicken wire below ground or the wire below ground to prevent rodents from crawling underneath? Is chicken wire appropriate, or is there another better product? Also, she has some sweet Sicily seeds and wonders if it's too late to stratify them this fall.
Okay, let's start with the choke cherries and shrubs and trees in general. And there are many, many different strategies to protect woody plants from the never-ending marauders of deer and mice and voles and all these things that love to eat them, especially voles in the winter. Oh, my God. So I will tell you what I do, and I'm not saying that this is the be-all, end-all, but it works for me. And if you have a tree, those tree tubes are the best, and they're easy, they're cheap, and they really protect your tree. And these like 5-6 foot tall tree tubes, once they get up 6 feet, then a deer can browse them, so that can be a problem. But it really protects them from a lot of problem critters. What I do on my property, and maybe this isn't the most efficient method, but I go to my favorite place to shop in the whole wide world, Fleet Farm. And as I tell my long-suffering partner, I do all my shopping at Fleet Farm, including my clothes. And she says, yeah, and it shows. I love Dickies. My friends make fun of me because I wear Dickies. But you know what? Those things wear forever. And I go to Fleet Farm and get my boots and my Dickies, and I'm one happy dude. But moving right along. So I go to Fleet Farm, and I get 5 foot tall woven wire, and get like a 50 foot roll. You can get a 100 foot roll if you're really strong, but as I get older, a 50 foot roll is a lot easier to use. I then cut it into 5 foot lengths, and then I just bend over the every other one of the I leave one end with the wire cut, and then one end where it's cut flush with the actual up and down top to bottom wire. So I can have a little wire that I can hook around it, and I make these little cylinders. And then I use 2 electric fence posts, and I weave the post through that wire, and that's what I use to stick it into the ground and just pound it in the ground with a mallet. And I put in the tree, and I put one of those plastic tree protectors about 2 feet high around the tree, and then I put this woven wire 5 foot piece, and now it's a cylinder around the tree. And that keeps the deer out, it keeps the mice out, it keeps the voles out. I've had very good results with it. Make sure that you remove that white plastic collar before the tree grows into it. And I have been a little lax on a couple of these, and you can kill a tree with those things. I mean, it can actually girdle it. Okay, I have not actually lost a tree, but I've had the plastic incorporated in the tree, and that's really not considered to be a very smart thing to do. But, you know, I only can do so much in a day. But and make sure that you protect the tree the day you plant it, because one day I planted a bunch of trees, and I was like, oh, I'm too tired. It's getting dark. I'll put up the protection tomorrow morning. Well, tomorrow morning was a little too late, and Bambi showed up and really made a mess of everything overnight. So make sure that you time your work so that you can make sure and protect it before the evening. This is what I do, but there are many other strategies. And the problem with chicken wire is it's only a few feet tall.
Yeah.
Okay. And that's not going to protect you from deer. It's going to protect you from rabbits. It's going to protect you from mice and voles. Well, even that, I don't know if it's going to protect you from mice and voles. I don't use chicken wire. So I did have, like, I don't know, I got this big pile of chicken wire that was left over from whoever owned the place before, and I made this, like they were 3 feet tall, and I put 2 of them together to make them 6 feet tall, and I put them around a beech tree, and it was like the, you know, the hillbilly tree protector, and it worked great. But I've kind of advanced over time. So it really depends on what pests you are trying to protect, but the combination of the tree, those little white, you know, spiral tree protectors and a 5 foot fence usually works pretty well. Or you can use the tree tubes, but it doesn't necessarily work for multi-stemmed shrubs. So you have to be careful about that. You can't cram them into one of those tree tubes.
Peggy Sue and Brillian, we'll go to you now. Hi, thank you for calling.
Well, thank you very much for the plug there, Neil. I actually am on my way to work at the Appleton Fleet Farm. So, yeah, I cashiered or started in the garden center this year. And I love people like you. Anyway, I just wanted to call because we put in a new septic system this year. Our old one got holes in the steel tank, and we had a mess. So we're looking to – I just got your catalog. I'm so excited. I'm going with the septic mix. But I guess my only question for you is, being the president, you probably have the best idea for me. I need to know how I can spread 1 pound of seed on – top of a 103-foot long field and make it work.
Sure. Okay. So let's start with a... I'm sorry.
I hand cast everything. I do it all by hand. I do all my seeding that way for grass, and it works super.
Okay. And that was 140 by what?
It's 103 by 30 feet wide. So it's a pretty good-sized tank field. I've already talked to the county guy, and he suggested like a quarter acre to a half acre size mix. When I called your office, they told me that the guy there told me that he said I would suggest a pound to 2 pounds.
Yep. And you said it was 103 by 30, is that correct?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay, got it. First of all, before you use that mix, I want to make sure, and this is a common issue, is that septic mix has dry prairie species that grow in dry sand in it. And if your contractor has placed 6 inches of topsoil over the top of that sand and gravel backfill that they put in for septic mixes, you do not want to use that septic mix. So this is very, very important because the species in that septic mix will not grow very well in a typical Appleton clay topsoil. So have they put any topsoil over it?
Peggy, have they put these...
Because we had already discussed that I wanted to turn this into a wildflower garden. I thought it would be beautiful out there. I'm one that, yes, I love the monarchs, and I have let my silo garden completely take the milkweed take over. So they have all the milkweed, and I have swamp milkweed nearby. So they have all the milkweed they need, but I want to protect the bees. I dearly love the bees.
Sure. But has your contractor put any topsoil over the sand and gravel backfill on your septic system?
Yep. And it's actually pretty nice topsoil. It's not as clayish as the stuff I get when I order it from a contractor near me, but there is some clay in it.
Okay, but it's not the dry sand that was there on the septic mound or septic system.
No.
Okay, then you don't want to use the septic mix for this. Okay, as it's very clearly stated in our catalog and on our website, this is designed only for raw base sand and gravel backfill for very dry species. Okay, so what you can do, and without really knowing a little bit more about your soil or the depth of the soil, but if they put 6 inches of topsoil on there, you do not want to use a dry prairie mix. You want to use a medium prairie mix because it's a totally different soil now, completely different soil. So, but we have other mixes you can use. You can use our short prairie for medium soil, which would be an excellent choice for that situation. And it's going to give you the same effect, if not better. Okay, but definitely the species in that septic mix are for dry sand and gravel only, not for a topsoil situation where you've got a medium soil like a silt loam or a loam. So, but it's very simple. You would still use the same amount of seed. And since you have about 3,100 square feet, 1 pound of mix covers 4,400 square feet. So as long as the seed is evenly distributed, you only need a pound of seed. You can use more if you want. It won't hurt. But 1 pound should be sufficient. Now, how do you do this? And you will find that we have directions to come with our seed mix, and we have directions all over our website and directions. So you can find out how to do this. But here's the basic thing is you have to dilute that seed because a pound of seed to cover 3,000 square feet, you're not going to do that by going out there and doing it by hand. Because I did that on my first prairie 45 years ago, and believe me, it was an impossibility, and it took me forever. It took me days, okay? And I realized, dude, this is not working. So you need to dilute the seed with a carrier. And there are many different carriers that you can use, but what I have found is the easiest, simplest, and least work is using sawdust. If I can get sawdust from a sawmill or a woodworking shop or wherever, sawdust is light. It's easy to work with. It's loose. And I just slightly dampen the sawdust, just a little bit, to make the seed stick to it. If it's gloppy and wet, no, won't work. It's just going to be slightly damp. And then you homogenize that seed into the sawdust, and now you can spread it across the area. So how much sawdust do you need? Generally, 2 bushels per 1,000 square feet. But you have to be over 40 to know what a bushel is. Okay, so I can make this really simple. Okay, a bushel is basically 2 5-gallon pails. So per 1,000 square feet, you would need 4 5-gallon pails of sawdust. And so for 3,000 square feet, you would need a dozen 5-gallon pails of sawdust. And it wouldn't hurt to have a few more just to make sure you have lots of material to dilute the seed with and cover the area. So you homogenize the prairie seed into it, mix it and look for that seed. You'll be able to see the seed against the sawdust. The sawdust is usually brown or red or orange. Well, not red, brown or orange. And you can see the seed. And when you see sawdust with no seed in it, you need to keep mixing. Once it's mixed, then what I do is I will divide that mix, in your case with 3,000 square feet, divide the mix of the seed and the sawdust in half, and then go out and divide the area to be seeded in half. And start with one half of the mix on that first half. This allows you to get an eye for how much area you're going to cover. So I would divide that into the 1,500, 1,600 square feet each, and apply the first half on the first half. And if you make a mistake and you don't quite finish, you still got that other half where you can go and touch up that first half and then scale it back a little bit on the second half. But you want to make sure that you get a feel for it right off the bat. So this is good for small areas. Once you get over about a half an acre, a half an acre is a lot to do by hand. But there are other methods where you can use spreaders, like an AgriFab spreader, which is it's a really good product, and it's really reasonably priced. And you can get it at Fleet Farm, by the way. And you can then dilute the seed with a carrier like pelletized lime, cracked corn, or whatever. And the same thing is you homogenize it, but you're going to use significantly less than this 4 5-gallon pails per 1,000 square feet. And you will calibrate the seeder first with the lime or the cracked corn or whatever carrier it is first before you add the seed, and it will be a fraction of the amount that you would use for doing it by hand. So that's a whole other discussion. I don't know if we want to spend a lot of time on that, but that's how you do it. You got to dilute that seed unless you have a precision seeder where you can put the seed into the specific seed boxes, but usually that's for areas of a half an acre or larger. So for small areas, dilute the seed with a carrier.
There you go, Peggy Sue. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Neil DeBoe, president of Prairie Nursery, our guest today. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network. Taking a look at prairie plants and prairies on the program today with Neil DeBoe, president of Prairie Nursery. Great to have him with us today. By way of full disclosure, we should mention that Prairie Nursery is one of Wisconsin Public Radio's many business sponsors. Questions for him, please feel free to join in, and let's go to Paul in Madison next. Hi, Paul.
Hi, Neil. I wanted to know any kind of tips or tricks, questions about modifying and doing some things to an existing prairie, and I have a couple examples I wanted to ask you about, some more specific examples. I have a small front yard garden, prairie. The whole yard is prairie. And there's about 1/8 or a little bit less of it is been taken over by this kind of spindly, I think it's a field mustard plant and some burdock and some other things. And I've been pulling it for a couple of years, but it's stronger than me. And so I wanted to know about maybe some strategies, maybe spot spraying and reseeding that area to get some more diversity and compete with that stuff. And the other specific example I had is I have a few paths in there, and I was thinking about adding some path sedge or maybe some no-mow lawn or something to keep those paths and then mow them, just small paths. And so I know it's hard to kind of tame and tell a prairie what to do, but I was wondering if you had some ideas about that.
Okay, let me get a little more information here, okay? So the weeds that you're having problems with are what again?
It's a mustard plant, and I think it's like a field mustard. It's kind of low-growing with some long oblong leaves and kind of very spiny, spindly stems, but it's definitely a little yellow mustard plant.
Okay, the stems are spiny? Have spines on them?
Yeah, so it's not spines. It's just instead of like a stout stem, it's kind of a very flexible stem. So it kind of winds around other plants and forms like this mat. It's almost like, you know, morning glory vines or something at the top of them.
I'm not sure what mustard that would be. That's is it a perennial or an annual? Does it pull out easily from the root?
Not that easily, no.
Okay, I doubt it's a mustard because most of the mustards we have here are annuals. That's not to say it isn't a mustard, but I'm trying to figure out what this is because your strategy for controlling it will depend upon the species.
Yeah.
Okay, without knowing the exact species, it's impossible for me to give you any really good advice because it's very specific to what you're fighting. Burdock is a biennial. Okay, that's pretty simple. Okay, so, but when I hear about these sorts of, when I hear burdock being a biennial, generally needs open soil in order to germinate. So that tells me you have open soil in your prairie garden. And open soil is the kiss of death because that's where weeds germinate and grow. So the whole idea of a prairie garden is to plant the plants closely enough together, the flowers, the grasses, et cetera. And this is where grasses are really important because they occupy so much of the soil rooting zone. That's what really helps to squeeze out the weeds. So if you don't have grasses in your prairie garden and it's only flowers, because many flowers do not have fibrous root systems, you have all this open soil where weeds can grow, and it becomes a lot of work. So it defeats the purpose of having a prairie garden. That's, again, why grasses are really important. You should have at least 1/3 to 50% grass in a prairie garden, and it gives you that winter interest as well. Plus, it supports the flowers. So the first step is to make sure you have the plants densely enough planted to prevent weeds. So prevention is the easiest way to do this. Burdock being a biennial, obviously you want to make sure it doesn't go to seed, but burdock seeds can remain viable in the soil for decades, so even if you prevent it, they're still going to come up. If you have an established burdock, you can do this with many biennials. Burdock has a very thick root. When the plant is in flower, and you'll never see the flowers because they're very, very small, but when you start to see those seeds forming, you can go with a tile spade, a narrow tile, and just insert it into the soil a couple inches below the soil and cut the root diagonally and pull the top of the plant out, and that's it. It's done. It's finished. Remove it from the site, and you're done with the burdock. This mustardy plant, without knowing more about it, really, really hard to say. But spot spraying is generally not recommended because it's so easy to do collateral damage to the adjacent good plants. You have to be really, really, really careful. Now, I can spray within 1 inch of a good plant, but you got to know what you're doing. There's also a method, if you are going to spray plants, you can take a backpack sprayer, one of those pump sprayers, and you can take a plastic clear soda bottle and cut the bottom off, cut half of it off, and leave the neck part. And then you can unscrew the nozzle on the wand of the sprayer and put that half of the soda bottle back on it, slide it up over the wand, and then apply the nozzle back on there, and then tape that where the screw top would go, tape that onto your wand, and now you have this little death zone, this little cone of death, okay, and that will prevent spray from going outside of that cone. So if you absolutely have to feel that you have to go and spray a perennial, sometimes there are certain weeds that require that, like Canada thistle. It's almost impossible to pull out Canada thistle because it has roots that go 18 to 24 inches deep and creep all over the place. Same thing is true of crown vetch. But if you get crown vetch, you got huge problems on your hands. And so these are a couple of weeds that are almost impossible to pull out. So this is where you might actually want to resort to herbicides. And Canada thistle and crown vetch and field bindweed, all three of these are really, really nasty, noxious weeds that are hard to pull out. But if you're going to use herbicides, don't use Roundup because they are resistant to Roundup. So you'll have to use the specific herbicide that will kill each of those. And they do vary by species to species. So what works on one weed may not work on another. So, for instance, I can kill buckthorn with milestone, aminopyrrolate. Okay? No other herbicide have I used that will completely kill it. As a foliar applied herbicide in late summer or early fall will kill buckthorn. I have to mix Roundup and Garlon to get it killed. But milestone will kill it. You spray milestone on garlic mustard? Huh? It's like it fertilizes it. So you have to be very specific. If you're going to use herbicides, you have to know exactly which one you're using for which target in many cases. So there's many different strategies to this, but the trick to this is prevention. Make sure that your plants are closely enough together to prevent the invasion by weeds as much as possible. As far as your trails, as far as using path rush is a great option for usually semi-shaded areas, and it's really tolerant of a compaction and foot traffic, and it'll grow in a wide variety of soils. So that would certainly be a reasonable choice.
There you go, Paul. Thank you so much for calling. Do you cut down your plants in the fall, or do you leave them stay up for winter interest, somebody's wondering?
I leave my plants up not just for winter interest, but also for habitat, for all sorts of invertebrates, pollinators, et cetera, and for birds. And this is really, really important. It's one of the things that people are really starting to recognize is how important it is to leave up your flowers, your grasses, et cetera. Number one, you're going to have birds foraging in there all winter long looking for seeds, insects, et cetera. And the grasses, especially if you have a tall prairie, a lot of those grasses provide protection during winter storms for birds and other critters. And equally important, if not more so, is a lot of different invertebrates, insects, et cetera, will overwinter as eggs, as pupa, as adults, in the stems, in the ground, in the soil right underneath it, in the leaf litter. And so there's a whole ecosystem of life that is removed when people cut things down in the fall and throw it all in the compost pile or burn it or whatever in the fall, and you're taking away all this life that you could have had otherwise, which includes all, a number of different butterflies, pollinators, etc. So
there we go. Neil DeBoel, our guest today, president of Prairie Nursery and a consulting ecologist. His book is titled The Gardener's Guide to Prairie Plants. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Taking a look at prairie plants and prairie gardening on this edition of Garden Talk. Larry Mueller here with Neil DeBoel, president of Prairie Nursery. Always great to have him come by. He's the author, co-author of the book, The Gardener's Guide to Prairie Plants, a dandy of a book. Questions for him, I hope you'll join in. Number to call 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234, or send an email to ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. Chris in Bagley emailed and asked if you could talk about the invasive wild parsnip and how to get rid of it. They have small patches that are growing on their property, getting to be a problem.
Oh, boy, wild parsnip. Yep, that's a nasty non-native biennial. And one of the big issues, not only is it invasive, but it is has phototoxic properties where if you get the sap on your skin in the sun, it can cause, in some people, severe burns, worse than poison ivy, actually. So, first of all, you have to be extremely careful when you're dealing with it. Make sure you wear long sleeves, gloves, and long pants. And you need to prevent it from receding. And it's interesting. Most biennials are relatively easy to control, and what you do is you simply cut them when they have just completed blooming. Allow them to bloom. Cut them and remove, you don't even have to remove the cut material because the seeds have not yet formed. So you have a large patch. As soon as that biennial has finished blooming, you just cut it down and let it rot, and that will kill the plant. It will not resprout. And it will not form seeds because you cut it before it had time to produce viable seeds. So this is the easiest, simplest way to control biennials. This works for sweet clover. It works for burdock. It works for wild parsnip. It does not work. It works for bull thistle. It does not work for Queen Anne's lace. And why doesn't it work for the beautiful, lovely Queen Anne's lace that we all love? Because Queen Anne's lace is an indeterminate bloomer. These other biennials are determinate bloomers. This also works for garlic mustard. And that's a whole other discussion, but it's all the same process. But Queen Anne's lace is an indeterminate bloomer. You can cut it after it has plants. The flowers on the plant bloom at all different times. And so you can cut it, but then it reblooms. And you can cut it, and then it reblooms. And every time it reblooms, lower to the ground, making it harder to find and harder to cut. So Queen Anne's lace is really hard. But the wild parsnip is really easy to control. And also many of these seeds of biennial, non-native biennials, like the sweet clover, can remain viable in the soil for decades. But it seems as though wild parsnip seeds do not remain viable for decades because areas where I have controlled this by doing this repeatedly, after 3 or 4 years, it's mostly gone. Okay, now, it's never going to be all gone, but the new recruitment rate in areas where it has been controlled for a period of 3, 4, 5 years tends to be quite diminished. So it's a little bit easier to control than things like sweet clover, which can persist for decades, even though you don't let any of the plants go to seed. And this is what's so frustrating about some of these. You are absolutely super careful about keeping them under control, but yet they still appear from year to year. I have a prairie that I planted in the early 90s, and it was solid sweet clover in the first 2 years because it all germinated from dormant seed. There was no sweet clover growing there. It was a box elder woods. Box elders were 35, 40 years old. There was not a sweet clover in there. I cut them down, killed everything for 2 years, and it erupted into sweet clover. I made sure that none of those sweet clovers went to seed, and yet 30 years later, I'm still pulling sweet clover, although now it is almost gone. It only took 30 years. So there you go. Okay. So the good thing about wild parsnip is it can be controlled much faster than a lot of these other biennials, and garlic mustard can remain, the seeds can remain viable for 10 years, and I have areas where I've been controlling it for 10 years, and it's almost gone. So.
There we go. Rick in De Pere emailed. He bought a seed grass mix from Prairie Nursery last fall for a 1,500-square-foot parcel. The flowers are doing great. Soil is mostly clay and sand. Two questions. Black-eyed Susans are the most prominent. Should they worry about them taking over, and should we do something to mitigate their expansion? And then the second, the grasses in the seed mix didn't do well. He believes it's because of fall planting. Wonders if that's correct.
Okay, he is absolutely correct that you will see diminished germination of the grasses with the fall seeding. If your goal is primarily flowers, then seed in the fall. If your goal is primarily grasses, seed in May or June. And some people will increase the grass seeding rate in the fall if they want a good representation of the grasses. The grass seed, with the exception of prairie drop seed and a few others, is generally cheap. The warm season grasses like big blue stem, Indian grass, little blue stem, Cytos grama, the cost of that seed is cheap, especially on small areas. So you can add a few ounces or a few pounds, depending upon the size of your area and the seeding rate. You can double the seeding rate in the fall to improve the amount of grass or increase the amount of grass that you will have in that planting. So that is a strategy to handle that. As far as worrying about the black-eyed Susans taking over, he should be more worried about the black-eyed Susans disappearing. And this is a natural successional event. Black-eyed Susans are a biennial, and when seeded in the fall, oftentimes they will bloom in the first growing season, which occurred in his situation. And so those plants are going to make seeds, and then the plants will die. He will probably have lots of black-eyed Susans next year, in the second year, and then starting in the third year, he will start to see a diminishment, assuming that the prairie is progressing according to plan, which is usually the case. By the third and fourth year, the black-eyed Susans will become increasingly less common, and by the fifth and sixth years, they may very well almost disappear. This is natural. This is the concept of natural ecological succession. So in the first year of any planting, no matter what you're planting, you're going to have lots of annuals that germinate, usually from dormant seeds in the soil. The second year, biennials will be dominant, like black-eyed Susan, brown-eyed Susan, dotted mint on dry seed mixes. And if you have weeds, the weeds that we just talked about, sweet clover and Queen Anne's lace and wild parsnip, if they are present in the seed bank. Then in the third year, you really start to see the expression and really consolidation of the soil environment and the foliar environment by perennials, like purple coneflower, yellow coneflower, bergamot, and the prairie grasses start to come on pretty strong in the third year, at which point the open soil that biennials like black-eyed Susan need to germinate and grow becomes less frequent. And so you have less germination, and then you have less biennial flowers by the fifth, sixth, seventh year. And usually by the eighth or ninth or tenth year, everybody says, what happened to my beautiful black-eyed Susans? Like, what did I do wrong? Well, you didn't do anything wrong. That's just nature. Okay. So worry about the diminishment of the black-eyed Susans. Enjoy them while you have them.
There we go. Man. Well, let's go to Michelle in Dodgeville next. Michelle, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. I have an area, like maybe 20 by 40 feet, that I want to make into just like a silphium patch because I like them. So would you recommend doing that by seed or by start?
How much money you got? That's really the question, Michelle, because and this is the never-ending conundrum of life. It's time or money.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And silphiums are what we would call climax prairie species. They're long-lived species. I mean, there are people who hypothesize that a compass plant can live 100 years. And there are documented cases where they're 60, 70 years old. I know plants that are 45 years old since I started doing this. Okay, so they tend to be prairie dock, compass plant, rosinweed, and cup plant. The four silphiums that we have here in Wisconsin tend to be extremely long-lived. Okay, so most long-lived plants take longer to grow from seed to reach blooming stage. This is a pretty much a universal phenomenon. So your long-lived plants like members of the genus Baptisia, the false indigos or wild indigos, very slow growing, but they live for, I won't say forever, but decade upon decade. So if you're going to go from seed, be prepared to take generally about 5 years for most of your silphiums to reach maturity. The exception, of course, is the irrepressible cup plant, and I would encourage you not to plant cup plant because it can get way out of control and dominate everybody when it gets 12 feet tall and smothers out everything. So if I were doing a silphium garden, I would do rosinweed, I would do compass plant, and I would do prairie dock, unless you have certain preferences. Do not plant the cup plant because it just gets a little wild. A great, wonderful wildlife plant. Oh, my God. The birds love it. The insects love it. But it really doesn't respect anybody's boundaries. Okay. So if you go with plants, the thing about – here's the other thing. You are going to have weeds if you don't put in grasses or some other fibrous-rooted forbs because all except the cup plant, the other three silphiums, compass plant, prairie dock, and rosinweed are taproots. And so they're going to leave open soil beneath them. And that's where all your weeds are going to grow. So you're going to have a big weed patch underneath them if you don't include grasses or spreading roots or rhizomatous flowers to join them. Okay, so you want to take that in consideration. But the cost of the seed is going to be an order of magnitude less than the cost of putting in transplants. So what do you do? Here's what I would do if I were in this situation. I would plant a prairie seed mix. You've got 40 by 80? Is that correct, Michelle?
It's more like 20 by 40. It's just like a
I'm sorry. I got that wrong. Yeah. Yeah. I was doing 800 square feet. Okay. So you can get a quarter pound of a prairie seed mix. This may be inconsistent with what you want to do, but I'm going to try and make this as easy as possible for you. So you can get a quarter pound of, say, a short prairie. Short prairie meaning 1 to 5 feet tall. And then you can put in either seed of the silphiums or in the second growing season, not the first year, but the second year, you can go in and transplant groups of the various silphiums that you want in that prairie where you want them. And this is the nice thing about putting in transplants. You get to put the plants where you want them as opposed to a seed mix where they just show up where they come up. Now, you can scatter the seeds where you want them, and they'll come up where you scatter the seeds. That also works. Why do we put in the transplants in the second year? Because in the first year when we do a prairie seeding, because the planting tends to be dominated by annuals in the first year, part of natural ecological succession. We keep the weeds mowed back to 6 inches because very few of the prairie seedlings will grow more than 6 inches tall in the first year, but the weeds will grow 6 feet high, depending on your soil, rainfall, etc. So we don't want those weeds topping out those little prairie seedlings and smothering them, so we keep the weeds mowed back to 6 inches in the first year. If I put in transplants and those transplants want to grow a foot or two tall, I'm whacking them back unless I have to work around each and every one, which is a real pain. So we establish the prairie seed mix in the first year. Then we go in the spring of the second year, we put in the transplants because our management protocol for a second-year prairie seeding is in the first half of the year to three-quarters of the year before we get into August, is to mow it at 12 inches to stop biennials from making seed like we just talked about, like sweet clover and wild parsnip, etc. So most of your silphiums are not going to get more than 12 inches tall in the second growing season, so you won't harm them by that second-year mowing program. So this is what I would do if you want a low-maintenance prairie. If you want to go out there and mulch it and weed it and do all that and just have silphiums, then certainly that's an option, and you can put in the transplants as you see fit. Or I wouldn't seed it because you'll never be able to control the weeds if you just seed it. Does that make sense?
Total. Thank you so much.
Absolutely. Good luck. And if you have any more questions, just let me know. You can call me at the nursery.
All right. Michelle, thanks a lot for calling. Doug in Sister Bay, we go to you now. Hi, Doug.
Hi. My question had to do with, I have about a two-acre patch that used to be a cherry orchard. And then that dilapidated, it started to reforest itself. But I didn't want that to happen, so I just keep mowing it down. But if I were to do something with a prairie garden like this, the popples next to this grassy, weedy area that I keep mowing want to keep coming up. And how do I control those, those shoots that come, 7,500 feet into the field?
Yes. Yes, you bring up an extremely good point, Doug. And, popples and sumacs, these are the shock troops of the forest, and these are the invaders. So this is why you see them at the edge of the forest where they have lots of sun. They're not really shade tolerant, and they extend that wooded ecosystem into open grasslands, and you are never going to stop them short of eliminating them in the source. So you're probably not going to go in there and cut down all the popples and treat them to kill them. So you now have to make a decision. Is this a good place to put a meadow? And I would say, unless you are willing to spend the time to control the invasion of the popples that come into your prairie meadow, it is not a good space. And not every open field is an optimal situation for a prairie, especially next to invasive plants like the popple. So if you do decide to do this, you can control the popple with annual fall mowing. But now you don't have the ability to, well, you could do spring mowing as well. That would allow you to leave the prairie standing over the winter for habitat. So you can go in there every year and mow the popple back. It's a little bit different. You're going to have popple sprouts that get 3, 4, 5 feet tall every year, and you're just going to have to keep them mowed back in order to maintain, to arrest ecological succession, the tendency towards invasion and development of forests over the grassland. So if you have a choice, I would pick another location where you're not going to have a constant pressure from the popple, or commit yourself to mowing it every single year, usually in Sister Bay, probably sometime in early May, just as the plants are starting to come up.
There you go, Doug. Thank you very much for calling. And we're on to Ellen in Cedarburg next. Hi, Ellen.
Hi. I have seen a very, very attractive tall plant with a purple bloom that I thought was lead plant. And I'm wondering if you might know what it is. I can't give you much more detail because I only see it driving past.
And where do you see it? Do you see it extremely tall?
I see it in prairie and wetland areas, both.
Okay, and in the Cedarburg area?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Okay, and it's about, let me guess, 8 to 12 feet tall, is that correct?
Yes, yeah.
Okay, and it's a shrub. It has a very spreading shrub-like form, correct?
No, it is a straight stem.
A single straight stem.
Unless it is a shrub at the bottom. But no, I don't think so.
Hmm.
Oh, boy. Well, and it has flowers that look like lead plant with those nice purple flowers with the orange highlights?
Yes. Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
I would suggest you investigate Amorpha fruticosa, okay, also known as indigo bush, okay? And indigo bush tends to grow along streams, so it would be in low wetter areas. Okay, it's not restricted to that. It's very common along the lower Wisconsin River, and it loves growing in sandy, silty areas along rivers. It's not restricted to that, but that's its preferred habitat. So if you can look up Amorpha fruticosa or indigo bush, and then compare that to what you're seeing, and see if that isn't what you are observing. That would be my best guess, because most of our shrubs in Wisconsin do not have purple flowers. Most actually, you know, what the joke among landscape architects and designers is, oh, native shrubs, okay, the white flowers in June. That's about it, okay? Whether it's a cornice or a viburnum or whatever, it's white flowers in June. Okay? And I don't mean to be so painting everything with one brush, but that's what's really cool about the indigo bush is it's very different. It blooms later in the summer. And it has quite a bit of stature to it. It has those beautiful lead plant type flowers with the purple and the highlights of orange in it. So yeah, orange is yellow. So check it out. Amorpha fruticosa, another legume to improve your soil.
Ellen, thank you for calling. On to Jim in River Falls. Hi, Jim.
Hi. I got a couple questions. First of all, for controlling raspberries, I'm thinking triclopyr in fall. What time is a good time to buy that? Because I try to get them back in the spring, but obviously it doesn't kill them then. But just wondering what your recommendations are for that. Then I'm also wondering, is Jerusalem artichoke a native or non-native? And my final question is, I've got 5 acres of prairie in a field, but I also planted my yard to prairie quite a few years ago. But I guess I've got a little bit of a concern about some of the deep tap roots going down into my septic drain field. I'm just wondering what your recommendations are for that, and if there are certain plants to keep out of there over a septic drain field.
Okay, we got a lot of questions here. So let's start with your first question. That was control of raspberries. What are you controlling them potentially with triclopyr or another silvicide, a woody plant killing herbicide?
what is growing with this? Is it in something that you have plants that you want to protect, or you don't care what happens to anything else?
It's in the prairie. It's in the prairie. I'm trying to get it out of the prairie.
I would not use triclopyr because it could very well kill your flowers or some of your flowers.
Okay.
That could be disastrous. Okay. So this is why we don't generally recommend spraying herbicides in prairies unless you know exactly what you're doing and being super, super careful. So raspberries are extremely difficult to control. It's one of the most difficult weeds that I have in my prairie. You know what I do? I just go out there, put on my gloves, and go out and pull them after a rain and try and get as much of the root out as possible. It's a never-ending battle. So, but if you have a large area, it's really hard to keep up with them. They're really tough. Some people will go out and basil bark treat them in the winter, but still you'll have translocation of triclopyr into the soil, and it can kill flowers, even dormant flowers, really close by. I've done that before, much to my chagrin. So that's why I really try to avoid using herbicides in a prairie. Try and avoid using herbicides in general, but you got to be super, super careful. So I don't have a magic bullet for controlling rubus, the genus rubus, which includes raspberries, blackberries, dewberries, etc. Really tough, really tough. And this is just another case of a native plant that's one of the weeds. And Canada goldenrod is another native plant that's a horrible weed, worst weed in our prairies. Many people would agree. Canada goldenrod is the worst weed in our prairies. So,
what about a septic system and those plants, the roots that might grow into them?
Yes, that's a really good question. Our septic mix does not contain any taprooted, not really deeply taprooted species. That's why it's designed specifically for use on septic systems on only sand and gravel, not with topsoil or loamy or clay loamy soil on top. So that's specifically designed for that. Although I planted a prairie with some taprooted species on my septic system in 1982, and the tank failed. Not the septic field, the tank. Well, when they go to replace the tank, they have to go through the whole system. Well, they had changed the rules about the depth to modeling of soil since it was installed, and the depth to modeling. Now we were out of compliance, and we had to spend $10,000 on a mound system at our office. And when they exhumed the existing septic system, it was, the guy said, as good as the day it was installed with that prairie on top of it, which included some taprooted species. And this is why people hate government.
Oh.
$10,000 completely. All we needed was a $2,000 tank, but no, we were now out of compliance. But anyway, don't get me wrong, I'm not one of these crazy nuts about, you know, anti-this and anti-that. But the point is that the septic drain field was pristine, and I think a lot of that was probably because of the deep-rooted prairie plants that sucked all the junk out of there. So I don't really can't prove it, but anyway. There was a third question. Larry, do we have time for the third question, or are we running out of time?
We have run out of time.
Okay. All right.
You got two out of three of that ain't bad.
All right. Larry, it's been great. Thank you so much for the opportunity to engage with your listeners, and it's been a lot of fun.
Neil, thanks. Neil DeBull, president of Prairie Nursery and the co-author of the book, The Gardener's Guide to Prairie Plants, a dandy book, and I hope you have a chance to take a look at it. We'll get him back, and we will talk with him again for sure. Monday at this time, we will be talking with tech expert Jesse LeGrew, and he'll tell us about caring for a loved one's digital footprint after they die. That's Monday, starting at 11. In the meantime, thank you so much for listening. I hope you have a great Labor Day weekend. But for now, stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller.